Hey everybody, and welcome to the show. I'm James, that's Katie, and that makes this the first ever 15th episode of Cloud Control, the gaming podcast. It's not just good, it's good enough. And we've got a show that we hope is just good enough for you all today. Kate, as always, welcome. How are you today?
I'm good. You know, that's humbly what we're asking for, right? Like, yeah. We don't need to be the best. We just, you know, want to be entertaining at least a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I read, you know, the more personal fulfillment you can have, you just take the appreciations of the things in your life. You know, you just feel good about yourself. It doesn't need to be the best. It just needs to be good enough.
Well, there you go. A little extra philosophy lesson from us today. In addition to the games we've been talking about, and spoilers, I played a lot of God of War. Not as much as I would have liked, but enough that we have a lot to cover today.
I know. We were just going back through before we started to record, and we were thinking of like, okay, where were we last time we talked about it on the show? And we were like, oh my God, we're blown away with how early in the game we were. So there is a lot. There is a lot to talk about. And we'll get to that in just a minute, but we just had a little bit of housekeeping to get out of the way first. We mentioned on the last episode that we were selecting a new charity for all of our subscription donations for the year. Last year, of course, anyone who's listened to the show before will know that we raised money for prochoice.org/donate. We have a $1 subscription fee you can pay for to support our show if you'd like. 100% of that goes towards our donation for the year. So we did that for 2022. And in 2023, we will be donating 100% of those proceeds to the Canadian Red Cross, which of course helps out in a variety of ways all around the country from and donates to humanitarian aid around the world as well. So good cause. And thank you all so much for anyone that does support us in that way. We sincerely do appreciate the ability to raise even just a little bit of money for great causes. So thank you all very, very much. And we hope to raise more this year. So I think that's everything out of the way for housekeeping, Kate. On the topics of the show for today, we have number one, we'll be watching the trailer for Ant-Man Quantumania because neither of us have seen it and neither of us have been spoiled on it from what from what I gather, right? You haven't been spoiled?
Yeah, I've heard basically nothing. The only thing I've had about it today, ironically, is about an hour before we sat down to record, I got an email in my like spam email about pre-ordering tickets for this movie. So that is literally all that has come up in my life so
right.
far.
Right, so it's like, we better watch the trailer then. We got to get on it.
Yeah.
So we got that. After that, we'll talk about God of War, like we said, a big update on that game. And then lastly, I'm going to bring up a little game from Game Pass called Despot's Game, which is an interesting roguelike that I'm interested to see what you think of what I tell you about it. But without further ado, I think let's get to our first topic, which is, of course, the trailer for Ant-Man Quantumania. And we'll watch it along with all of our video watchers, I guess, as well. So here comes the trailer. Let's see what we think, and we'll talk about it.
You're an interesting man, Scott Lang. You're an Avenger.
Feels like forever since we watched.
You have a daughter.
I remember being one of the better ones, especially for the ones that felt like relatively self-contained.
Yeah.
We can help each other with that.
So it's Kang talking, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's one thing I knew, that he's kind of the bad guy.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm the man who can give you the one thing you want. What's that? Time.
I'm interested how big of a part his daughter will play.
Yeah. Well, it seems like because he wants time to like spend with his family. Because he lost it during the snap.
Right,
because
he was in the snap, right?
Yeah.
I don't care who this guy is.
Or he didn't get snapped, actually. He was stuck in that realm in the
truck. Right, yeah. Well, wherever he was, he wasn't there.
I think the visuals in this movie are going to be amazing. Like, this is one to see in theaters for how crazy they go with the, like, different realms that he's going to go to. You call a life.
I always think Ant-Man does a good job with the visual like effects too, like at least with his like own powers, like the way he shrinks down, I always think looks really good.
It kind of reminds me of Guardians of the Galaxy a little bit in terms of like, it's almost like very spacey. Even though it's not space.
Oh, MODOK.
Was that the stomach guy?
That's MODOK. I think. Or it's Arnim Zola, that guy from the card game. I think it's MODOK, though. Zola's
They're all guys in. From the card game.
Well, yeah, I know.
I know that guy who's the one drop. I like how they keep making Kang blue with like his little visor thing.
Yeah.
That's cute. Looks good.
Wow.
So that was an interesting trailer because they didn't really do tons of like story stuff aside from like a general premise of like, you know, like kind of a vague conflict, but it was a lot of very visual information, which hopefully you can watch this in video because it's maybe not the best to listen to otherwise.
Yeah, a lot of dramatic violin if you're an audio listener.
Yes, but a lot of different like locations and colors and like blue area and like tiny area where like everything looks like it's inside a vacuum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm very interested to see how they incorporate Ant-Man's, what's his name? The really funny friend who tells the stories and it gets narrated to his voice.
Oh, that's
Luis?
Right.
Is it Luis?
Luis, I think so.
I'm excited to see him.
He was not in this trailer, but he better show up in the movie.
Come on, of course. And the other thing too is like just with Kang himself, you know, it seemed like he was, I don't know, in the voiceover, he was like talking to Scott. And I wonder, like, are they going to portray him? Are they going to have some kind of relationship where they can chat? Or is he just going to be, like, all of a sudden just show up and, like, want to fight? Because he seems a little bit more peaceful, at least when we saw him in Loki, right? Like, he was kind of willing to chat with them, almost like he was bored.
Yeah. An antagonist in the sense of, like, he was, you know, like, against the characters we were following. But he wasn't, like, super violent. Or at least not that we saw. I mean, the ending on that show was kind of ambiguous, and he's really just, you know, like a final piece of the puzzle. But yeah, it's interesting to see if he'll be a little bit more like aggressive in this one, or if he'll be more of a like intellectual challenge, which could be more exciting than just like the big CGI fight at the end of the movie, like every other time.
That's true. Although to be fair, the end of that trailer kind of looked like a big CGI fight in a certain way.
That's that is true.
So I'm just trying to think now too. What was the last Marvel movie? Was it Shang-Chi that we saw?
It
in
was
theater?
The newest Black Panther.
Oh, of course,
was
Black
Panther. Most recent one. But I actually haven't seen that, so I'm behind now.
Okay,
I need to go watch that one first, probably.
Well, and like I said too, I thought Black Panther 2 was just it was really good. Like it's the best one they've done for sure of like phase. What is this phase 4? Like, I think it's for sure the best one. Shang-Chi was pretty good. And I actually read somewhere online today that this is supposed to be, like, the biggest, most important movie since The Change. Like, it's supposed to be akin to, like, the Civil War of, like, this phase. So, I don't know. I'm pretty excited to see how they change it up. I feel like it needs a bit of a spark.
Yeah, the last couple of things have been very, like, self-contained. And they've almost been, like, focusing more on the shows than the movies, it feels like. But I guess at the same time, it's easier to kind of throw those out. So, yeah, we'll see. I guess Kang is supposed to be also like the big bad of phase 4, and we haven't really seen him, so like his presence is maybe like necessary to set some stakes up. But
true we'll
see.
And MODOK,
like
that's interesting too, his
and
little
MODOK,
his little flying chair in his arms. He looks kind of cool. I'll have to go back and look at exact like freeze frame it on him and see. But
yeah, he looks like kind of a crushed up tin can with limbs.
Yeah, pretty
so
much.
That's exciting. Yeah, I think I'll definitely see this. I like Ant-Man. My favorite recent Marvel thing. So your favorite recent Marvel thing has been
Black Panther for sure. Right? Yeah. If we're counting movies, if we were talking TV shows as well, I might have to think a little bit. But I think it would be. Although I really loved WandaVision.
Okay, mine would be Moon Knight.
I
didn't necessarily expect to love that show, and it blew me away. So I really enjoyed Moon Knight. And it was like definitely the best show for me. And I feel like I haven't seen a Marvel movie in like years, which is
It does
weird.
Feel like a long time. Yeah, right? It feels like, well, I mean, if you miss Black Panther for sure, like, because otherwise you're waiting like, it's probably been like over half a year, which is unusual because usually there's like 5 Marvel movies a year and you're like going to the theater every couple of months. But we'll wait and see. We'll probably talk about it on the show in February when it comes out. So look forward to that in the future. And for now, let's get on to the big topic, which is God of War Ragnarok, the update. Now, just for people playing along at home here, I have finished the game like last week and I'm all done. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut on anything past where Kate is in the story as far as the plot. But this is your spoiler warning, everybody. If you've not played God of War up until, we'll say the part where something, we'll say it ends off with a moment with something happens with Brock. That would be a good, about halfway through the game, it's a good marker for you. So if you don't want to be spoiled up until that point, maybe skip forward ahead just a little bit, and we'll get past that part of the show for you. But for those of you who are in here, it's been a long time since we talked about God of War, and we were really early in the game when we did. So I'll pass it off to you, Kate, to take us through that little gap. And man, how are you enjoying the game? Are you still living? Is it still living up to your expectations?
It is absolutely living up to my expectations. I feel like I'm at like the perfect boiling point of the game, like that kind of like mid phase where I'm thoroughly like into the story. And every time I sit down, the stakes get raised. It gets crazier. Like, so many things are happening. So many characters having pivotal moments. And like, I am incredibly invested in this game. It's amazing we're standing and talking here right now, because like, I could be playing God of War right now, is how I feel about this.
It's true.
Yeah. So I think the last time we talked, we were in Spellheim, and we had just rescued Tyr, and that was super exciting. But oh my God, did we like pause right on the precipice of one of like the craziest things that happens in this game. So again, this is your spoiler warning. If you're not into that kind of midpoint where you just hang out with Brock for a bit, skip ahead, because you really do not want this game to be spoiled. But yeah, basically right after you get back from there, where we stop talking about it, is where Atreus gets his little sneaky mission, and oh my God, then suddenly it turns into, it's now Atreus and Sindri time.
And that's the best, some of the best time in the game right there, Atreus and Sindri time. Man, they just, that relationship is just great.
It blew my mind. Like, I thought about if he played as Atreus, because obviously that was like a big question coming into Ragnarok, is will he be a playable character? And like, if so, to what degree?
And we made a bet on that too, I'm pretty sure. In the episode before, we like made a couple bets, like if Kratos would die, if Atreus is playable. Mm-hmm. We'll have to look back on what we said.
I think, I think we said like it was kind of be like Red Dead, where you just Atreus like as an epilogue kind of thing, was my guess. And I think you said it might save to game 3, but obviously there's no game 3, so we were working with limited information.
No, I don't think I would have said that. We knew there was no third game. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah. But anyway, so that was cool, because it's a cutscene, right? Like, you're following Atreus in a cutscene, and then all of a sudden you realize, like, oh shit, like, I'm in control.
Yeah.
And you have to start moving him. And then, of course, him and Sindri go off on their way. And he's fun. Like, I like playing as Atreus. Like, it is great to be Kratos, but I don't know, something about Atreus, like the bow work, like I don't know if I prefer it or not, but it's amazing that it is like a consideration of mine that I might genuinely prefer playing as Atreus.
Yeah, well, I mean, Kratos is just one of those characters now too. Like, and obviously he feels different in 2018 than he does in the older games by quite a bit, but there's still like some like familiarity there, and it's a character you just know how he fights for so long, right? He feels like at home, and Atreus is definitely a change. I think he's definitely a lot faster. The bow's interesting. I originally did think that I liked him more than Kratos, but then as the game went along, I think I shifted back and just was like, this is a nice little switch up, but Kratos is like, oh man. Oh man, it's so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's nice to like kind of break up the cycle a little bit and have a little bit of variety, especially with Sindri. Like, Sindri doesn't really change gameplay, right? You're pressing square to have him throw stuff, but he's just so delightful with his stupid bag that he just pulls a million things out of.
I loved that detail.
and so they have a good adventure. You get a little bit of story as well on Brock and like why he's blue, which is just like, I wasn't expecting that to be so heartbreaking for Brock to have like a tragic backstory.
Yeah, I was on the same boat there. I never really even considered something like that, but it just goes to show, you know, like the depth to which they've considered these characters. And obviously that was something that was put into consideration in the first game, like planting some seeds. I'm sure there's going to be like references or, you know, they would have considered that. But it's just amazing how every single one of these characters, as you get to know them more, like, you know, we loved Sindri from the first game, but then you're right. Like, now he's your partner, you're playing with him, you get to have those side conversations. It just elevates them all. I feel like it's true of Brock, it's true of Sindri, it's true of, you know, everyone you interact with more and more in this game.
I'm at now, like, you have so many different combination team-ups of characters, because obviously, like, at that point in the game, I'm like, okay, cool. We get like Atreus and Sindri, and that's the equivalent of playing as Kratos with Atreus as the side character. And like, those are our pairings going forward. Like, great. I was perfectly pleased by that. Mm-hmm. But obviously, as the game continues, you get all these really unique pairups of characters that I was not expecting. And the game genuinely feels like, yeah, Kratos is still your main character, but it is an ensemble cast. Like, every single character shines, and, like, there's never a time where I've been like, oh, I don't want to be with that character again. Like, I wish, you know, X was here. It's just been really great so far at pacing you through all the different variations and teams.
I agree, and it's such a nice way to let you flesh out those characters more, you know, because we, like, I go back to Brock and Sindri all the time, but even Freya as well, like, the amount of time you get to spend with these characters in comparison to like Mimir and Atreus was something that's like, it was too bad almost, because it didn't make sense for them to all be together. So you didn't get to just know them as well in the first game, even though it did still feel like a really connected cast. But this game really elevates that, I think. And there obviously is more characters in this game, but I really appreciate the way that they, instead of making it the cast even bigger, they've like, you know, the scope is more about the depth of the characters, and I think that's a nice change, and it's just so believable, these relationships. That's what it keeps coming back to me, is like, you believe that, you know, Sindri and Atreus have this kind of goofy relationship, and they're sneaking around, and they both have their reasons to kind of be quiet about it, and like, you know, that back and forth. And it also is interesting too, because Sindri obviously is kind of a timid, meek guy, and it gives Atreus kind of that chance to flex his sort of taking initiative muscles, because obviously he's always the follower when it's Kratos. Like, you never question really what he's gonna say, but you know, it's different with Sindri. So I thought that was cool too, and he kind of comes out of his skin.
Absolutely, it's a totally different dynamic, and like you said, that's a way to flesh them out. But also, like, yeah, they interact differently when there's certain combinations of characters, right? Like, Kratos is a little bit more like, he talks to Freya more as an equal than he talks to Atreus. And so that's a very different kind of side of Kratos you get to see. And then obviously, like, yeah, Sindri and Atreus are different. So that was an amazing part of the game. And then you go to Alfheim, which was the next area you went to, which was really neat to see, because Alfheim is very different than in the first game, which was a large portion of game one. So it was cool to see how Alfheim kind of like makes a return. And especially that they reflect on their time in Alfheim. Like, they talk about how they got involved with the conflict of the elves. And then they ruminate in this game about whether or not that was actually something that they should have done, and whether or not they helped, or if they were, like, getting involved in a conflict that was totally over their heads and wasn't really theirs to meddle in. And that was a cool moment, because it just not only shows, like, how much the characters have grown, but also like the permanence of the world. Like, it really has picked up from 2018, and what you did there matters and is relevant to not only just the characters, but the world as well.
100%. And I love that reference, like the way that, you know, Atreus has grown up, because in the first game, he was so hellbent of like, oh, we have to save these elves. You know, like, he just runs in, he has that stereotype bias. He's like, oh, the dark elves must be the evil ones. You know, they're destroying whatever's going on. And then in this game, you can just see he's matured. The game is trying to say something about, hey, you know, like, you don't always know the full story of what's going on in certain sides. And this game goes on to prove, like, you know, maybe it's not as clear cut in this situation, at least, as other ones. And I think watching the characters get to contemplate that, especially after they spent such a long time in that realm in the first game, like murdering so many elves, and it, you know, they really did have an impact on that. And watching that kind of come to fruition in the second game, you know, with that extra added wise nature of Atreus that he's developing, is a really interesting, you know, journey to go on, I think.
And I think another interesting aspect of it too is it really shows that they're outsiders here, right? Like, Atreus was born here, but he's still young. He hasn't traveled all the realms. He's still learning. Like, he's got a lot to go. He's a teenager, right? And Kratos has a lot more experience under his belt, but he's new to Midgard. He grew up, and they don't shy away from it. Like, they referenced it, obviously, a decent amount in 2018, but I feel like the old Greek games come up even more in Ragnarok, or at least, like, more consistently. Like, maybe not quite as much as, like, that heavy-hitting moment from 2018, where, like, you know, you get the chains and Athena shows up, and it's, like, this, like, crazy moment. But in this one, it just seems to come up a lot in the conversations about Mimir asking him something about his childhood in Greece, or very, or like Freya is curious about it as well. And so it really kind of hammers home that, like, yeah, they're not from here, and this is new to them as well, like traveling to all these different places. And so they're not only coming in and impacting it, but they're coming in as people who, like, are still learning about the kind of, like, culture and the world that they're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it just goes back to what I think I'd mentioned earlier of just, like, it, this world is just so well realized, you know? Like, it makes sense that they would feel that way as outsiders in that realm, and they do, and it mm-hmm. just kind of locks in with everything that's going on in such a cohesive way. But yeah, and then, like, adding in what Mimir has to say about it as well, like, he kind of fills in those gaps just enough so the player has, like, enough context, too, which is something that I love about them being like a trio, because I just envision this relationship without a character like Mimir, and like the other two would have to know things they couldn't really know. Or like you'd have to do a lot more reading or something like that. But Mimir just really ties it all together and is like the guide, which is so perfect.
I have a new idea, and it's either a question or a tier list. And it's like, who is the best exposition character, or like who feels the most natural? Because Mimir, like, totally is an exposition character.
Yeah.
But he's so good at it that it feels natural, and like I never get off the boat if Mimir is telling a story, because I want to hear what he's saying. And like, he's just telling you information about the world. Like, he's got a personality and he's well written, but he's very largely a character that, like you said, is to be able to tell Kratos and Atreus, and then by extension the player, things that they don't know and mm-hmm. are relevant to know. And Mimir, at one point, I've got a note near this section of the story, he tells the story of Macbeth, and he doesn't call it Macbeth,
that's
but
right.
the way that, okay. but what he tells, like, he does, that is Macbeth. I caught that,
fantastic.
Which is cute. And one other cute thing in this section, if you do the side quest and you unlock those jellyfish, those, like, massive, beautiful jellyfish, which is really cool, they have a moment where, like, Atreus asks Kratos, and he's like, why did you save this thing with me? Like, you know, what's the point for you? And Kratos looks and he's like, well, like, you wanted to do it, and I basically just want to spend whatever time I have with you. Whatever time I have left with you.
Oh,
so, like, that was my motivation. And you're like, God, like, oh, it's way too early to cry in this game.
I know.
Like, how could you do this?
I felt the same way. And it's like, man, Kratos really has changed again from the first mm-hmm. one. Like, he just, that's a side of sentimental, you know, sentimental activity, we'll call it, that's like unheard of for him. He would never have said that before. Even if that's the way he did feel towards Atreus, he would have just grunted or like been silent or something. He would never have said that.
Or like at most he would have been like, oh, because you wanted to, but he would yeah. never have gone that extra step of being like, you know, I just want to spend time with you. And he goes back, and later on when you get access to the area again with Freya, you can release the second one, and they like have that beautiful where they go up in the sky and they dance around and they reproduce, and it's mentioned that the only way that they can reproduce is they have to die to do it. And both Kratos and Freya like agree that, like, oh, as a parent you do anything for your child, like even give your life. It's like, oh God, okay, Kratos is gonna die. Mm-hmm. But also like that coming from him sharing that moment with Freya is harsh, because it's like everything harkens back to Boulder.
Well, exactly, right? It's such an elephant in the it's not really an elephant in the room, like they're both well aware of it, but it's definitely like a giant boulder of tension between the two of them mm-hmm. that they're having to navigate through. And it really is a fascinating part of the game, like listening to them talk it through, and you can totally see like Freya is still so pissed at him, but then as the circumstances start to change and that it develops, you know, it's kind of interesting to watch them grow as two characters we know from the first game to now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we'll get more into Freya, but the next section after that is we are back as Atreus again, number two, which shows that nope, it wasn't just a one-time thing. Like playing as Atreus is a big part of this
game. Could you imagine if it was a one-time thing? That would be so disappointing.
That would be so disappointing. You could not put it that early in the game if it was a one-time thing.
It would
thing.
Just be, like, that's yeah, outrageous. Exactly.
But this was a cool section. This is where Atreus ends up in the Ironwood Forest, and he meets Angraboda, who we did know about in the trailers ahead of time,
mm-hmm.
But didn't know about as being like a semi-playable character with Atreus. And him learning about this, you know, like his giants, and learning about the culture with her, and seeing all those prophecy things about like Kratos' death and him being with Odin, And like just exploring this world with her was really, really interesting part of the game. I remember you saying like, just fucking wait till you get to this section. I knew exactly when I got there.
Yeah, definitely. It was such a nice break, you know, because you do a lot of fighting in this game, and even the puzzles, they can be like, you know, you got to work at them. And as an aside, I know there was a lot of discussion about like the puzzle hints and stuff in this game. I have no idea if they patched it or if like something changed, but I personally felt that as the game goes on, you get a lot less hints than you do at the start of the game. So I don't know if that's something you noticed at this point, but regardless of that, you feel like the same way?
You know what? I hadn't really thought about it, but now that you mention it, I think so. And I think it's very likely they put a patch out.
Because
it has updated a couple times since I've had it.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if maybe that's one of the things they adjusted. Or just when you get later in the game, they're less frequent because it's less tutorial-y section.
But either way, like, I like the way that the Angry Boda sections are less about the combat. They're more about, you know, you're walking through just this lush environment and having these kind of playful discussions. You know, they clearly have like a little bit of a little crush on each other, but it's, you know, at the same time, it's like Atreus is just so eager to question her about like the giants and learn more about his culture, because she really is the only connection that he has. And, you know, she has this knowledge, but she's so bound to what she thinks is the right thing. It's like, oh, you know, when is the right time to tell Atreus this stuff? It's really interesting to watch their dynamic. And I really think they're a nice break because they just seem so happy together. And everyone else oftentimes it's like, oh my God, like this is terrible. We're all going to die. You know, it's a nice break tonally.
I completely agree. Like, this is the breath of fresh air that came, I think, at a really good time in the game as well. And one other thing, and this is kind of where I first started noticing it, but you see it on a lot of different realms as well, is that this game just goes the extra mile of all these places feel like there's so much life in them. Like, there's so many creatures just out and about, whether that's like bugs flying around or there's like lizards on trees and rocks, and you get later into like forests and there's monkeys and all these different fantasy
the monkeys
creatures.
The monkeys were so cool to go through that part of the trees. Yeah,
I took in that like lake section where you're like throwing by them, I took so many screenshots. Like, it was outrageous how much time I just sat in like the stupid picture mode.
Oh my God. See, when I was playing that, they hadn't done the photo mode update. So I wasn't able to get the shots that I wanted. Not that I take a bunch, you know, but it was just, it was stunning.
I wasn't even in the photo mode. I was just like screenshotting, I guess. Like, I was just trying to line up screenshots. Oh, wow. It was ridiculous. But yeah, like these worlds are so incredible. You can see, I think that's my biggest indication of where the tech upgrade has come from 2018. Like, obviously the gameplay is more polished, obviously the graphics are better, but it's those extra little details of having so much life and so many unique creatures to the environment. And like, they don't talk about them. They're not important to gameplay. They don't come up. Like, it's just purely extra detail, but the worlds feel so real and so unique because of it.
100%. And it's more than just the creatures too, like the plants. Like, the plants are all alive. Obviously there's some that are like enemies to you, but even the ones that you don't have to kind of hit to make them stop spitting or whatever, like they're all just swaying in the wind, you know. There's like pollen coming off of them, the way the shadows go through them. Like, it's just so impressive, and it really does feel like a real place, you know. Like, I guess, I don't know if that's an exaggeration or not, but it moves in the way that you'd expect. There's like principles of design, you know, and you want your designs to match what's in the real world as much as possible. And it's like, man, we're really getting there with the way they can do it. And the water as well just looks, oh my God, I love water in video games these days. It just keeps getting better every time.
There is some nice water in this game. I don't know if it's Horizon nice, but it is nice. And Horizon, I would take God of War over Horizon any day. No offense, Horizon. But yeah, there's some cool mechanical stuff in this one too. Like, you get your rage as being a wolf now, and that's where this first gets introduced, which of course makes so much sense that's what that would be. And then you also get like the runic summons where you can like ride the elk into things.
I don't like riding that elk. It doesn't feel good to me.
I don't like riding that elk either, but I do it anyway because I think it's fun, just like thematically. You know, and they make a few jokes about Loki. It's like, oh, you know, she makes a joke about how like straightforward he is, he's not good at tricking people, and it's like, haha, because he's Loki, like the trickster god. And yeah, they just were a fun time. Like, you collect some fruit, like you just play Animal Crossing for an hour instead, and that's lovely. There was an interesting detail, and I haven't gotten closure on this, so I'm just bringing this up as an ongoing question, or maybe something to make you smile because you know. Okay. But they mention they mention that there's a soul in Atreus's knife. And I don't know what that is going to mean. It could be a giant, because this is also where you get introduced the fact that the giants are like in those
in the marbles.
Like in those marbles.
Yeah, which is a very cool detail, by the way. Very cool.
Very cool. They put the marbles in that snake.
Yes.
One marble in the snake, and I think that has to do with Jormungandr. I think that snake ends up as Jormungandr, and there's some weird time shenanigans going on. Because Jormungandr is, I think, in the mythology, Loki's son, which is weird. So if he kind of snaked him, maybe that's like
if he snaked him. he snaked him in there.
That could be like an interpretation of that side of the lore. But I don't know about the knife. I'm wondering, like, maybe it's Faye in the knife. It's like, where did he get that knife? But I really hope I've been thinking about that a lot lately.
Gotcha. Okay, well, I will not say a word about that, and we can revisit it later if we feel the need.
Okay, deal. So yeah, that was Angerboda. Is she a top, like, five character? Because I think we don't see a hell of a lot of her after this, and I really hope she shows up more often.
I'm not going to spoil what happens, obviously, past this, but I definitely would put her in my top few. I just loved her. Like, she was so charismatic, you know, like, and like I said, I think she really represents like optimism or like just a different tone than the rest of the characters. And I just really appreciated that for what she brought. So I liked her.
Me too. And I think it's interesting too, her like approach to fate is very much like an acceptance, like, but not like in a negative way. Like her kind of outlook
she's
is
at
like,
peace,
what's
right?
going to happen? Like, we're at peace with it, right? Like, make peace with it. This is our fate. Whereas like Atreus isn't sure like about what he feels about fate. And Kratos is very like, we make our own fate, that's what he wants to portray. Like, I think there's a part of him that's worried that the prophecies will come true, but that's very much his outward stance.
Yeah, and so, it's almost like a big science versus religion type of thing at the end of the day, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
In a way.
So it's interesting. I don't know what the game is going to end up saying about fate, but it definitely comes up every twist and turn. Like, every single character has a relationship to it, and they're constantly talking about it. So hers was an interesting perspective.
And the concept, too, is like, can you change your fate, too, right? Like,
yeah.
Because what happens with Freya, and she's or have we gotten to the part with Freya yet? You know what? I'll skip this until later. I don't want to spoil something for you. Continue.
Okay, we'll keep going. I was gonna say Atreus finally gets back. And obviously Kratos is pissed because Atreus just disappeared for a period of time. And Kratos is obviously paranoid that he's accepted Odin's invitation, which he has not. But Angerboda makes him promise not to say anything about the Ironwood Forest, because obviously it's a huge secret, and it could be very detrimental if that gets out. And while they're going to start to argue, Kratos and Atreus get interrupted with a cool Valkyrie fight, which turns out to be Freya.
It's pretty awesome. Awesome reveal.
Pretty badass. And she is basically saying, like, you know what? We don't have to like each other, but if you help me be able to realm travel and, like, kind of get out from Odin's control, then I will consider helping you, because I also want to take down Odin. We've got a common enemy here. And you take off with the next pairing of the game, which is Kratos and Freya, which you actually see quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
That has sort of dominated my last, I would say, like 15 hours of the game.
And so this is what I was going to say just previously, actually, was this point. It's a very nice segue. Is that, like, the idea of fate, right, and predetermination in this game is, like, all the characters have a stance on it. And for me, like, I liked this in relation to that, too, with Freya, because she's clearly out there trying to change her fate. Her fate right now is to be stuck in this realm and be, like, you know, sealed away. But she's going to change it and, like, take matters into her own hands, which I think is cool.
Yeah, she's interesting because she does want that, but she also, like, believes in fate to the extent of, like, you know, like, with almost telling Kratos he can't necessarily change his. Or at least that, like, she thinks he's the champion that Faye predicted. And Kratos is like, I am no one's champion. Like, I'm just here to help my son. And Freya's like, well, maybe you are. Like, so she's kind of almost pushing him to try to fulfill his fate. But at the same time, she is, like, breaking free from what her situation was. So
yeah,
for she me, that kind of comes across to me like she's got an agenda more than one of the other characters. Like, I like Freya and I trust her, but I don't trust her as much as I trust everyone else.
Interesting. Okay, that's really interesting. My take on it for her, like, the predetermination of, like, her the death of her kid and all this stuff. It's like, I almost thought that was her as a coping mechanism just because she felt like she wasn't able to save him from the first game. So I don't know. It's a different read, but I definitely see what you're saying.
But yeah, it adds on. Like, for now, they go to Vanaheim and you find Freyr camp, like, with her brother. And this is the area with the monkeys. Like, it's just so incredibly pretty here. You meet Brock and Brock's friend. I can't remember her name. The other dwarf.
Lunda, is it? No, that's not right.
I think it's Lunda. You're right. Yeah. That sounds right. But she says potentially what's the funniest line in all of Ragnarok's lore, which low-key Ragnarok is hilarious. Like, I laugh all the time playing this game. There's always so many funny little, like, lines and, like, moments, like, subtle things here and there. But she looks at Kratos, and she says to him, she's like, and she asks Brock, she's like, oh, is that tall glass of milk your bodyguard? Could you imagine calling Kratos a tall glass of milk to his face and he doesn't just, like, slam her into the ground? And if that isn't Kratos' biggest show of, like, character progression over these games, I don't know what is.
You're so damn right about that. It was so funny. And, you know, I just thought, like, the second she showed up, how could you not enjoy her? Like, you know, she sounds so much like the catch a ride person from Borderlands. I looked it up. It's not her, but it sounds like her. And it kind of makes sense, right? Because, like, we've documented, like, you know, Sindri's playable. We've obviously, some stuff happened with Brock. Like, it makes sense to kind of mechanically have another dwarf in the game to sort of take their place. Mm-hmm. But then obviously they've gone above and beyond just kind of putting some random NPC, and they've gave her this amazing personality and just this another comic relief, I guess, type of character. But it was fun to meet her for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so, yeah, Vanaheim, I think, was a really good section. I enjoyed it. There's a good amount of, like, puzzles and, like, exploration and fighting. And they have a lot of those arenas, which I've noticed are quite common in Ragnarok, but I really like them, where you have those, like, multi-leveled stories. And so, like, you kind of fight on the top and you're sort of using the chains to swing around from platform to platform, and you can, like, down on guys. And they just feel really dynamic in a way. Like, they're simple, but they add quite a bit when you're, like, looking for, like, who's shooting projectiles and, like, if you're going to swing over to them and take them out before going back to the other side, just kind of stuff like that. You get to use the plunging attack, which is always an exciting move.
It's true. And just one thing on that, too. I agree with you on those rooms. What I like about them so much is I thought about it in relation to, like, The Last of Us 2, which is, like, you know, they give you such big open areas compared to the first one. And sometimes it's fun to play around in those, but other times it's like, oh, man, this is so big. And what I appreciate about Ragnarok is those areas are always, like, quite small and you're never too far away from the action. Like, it really is a nice, you know, pace you can have, and you're able to swing around and move exactly where you want pretty quick with those chains or whatever you swing on. I just think it makes the combat so fun. Like, you never really get a break, you know, you can't really get away to heal too easily until the end. Those rooms are some of the most fun fights.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And they just look cool. Like, even when it's just a puzzle section using those chains, like, I'm not tired of them. They look fantastic. So that's good. I think this is the one section of the game where I don't necessarily have a complaint, because I did the side quest with Freya afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I could see, if you don't, them reconciling feeling very rushed, because after you break her tie to the land, she asks you if they can go back to kind of, like, her hometown, and you do a few little side quests with her, and kind of you help the people that she used to be, like, the god for. And they kind of finish off in the main section where she hasn't forgiven Kratos, but she's accepted him, kind of idea, where, like, she's going to work with him. She's accepted that she understands why he did it, but she just isn't able to forgive him. But I feel like after that, they become quite a bit closer. Like, that frigid aspect of the relationship kind of, like, for lack of better terms, it defrosts. And they become a bit close. they take the Leviathan axe to it, you see, and they warm it up.
Of course.
And I think a lot of that development felt natural to me doing that side quest area, because, you know, Kratos learned a lot more about her and, like, how she was forced to go marry Odin and how much of a struggle that was. And then Baldur was, like, her only link, like, the one thing that she was living for. And he really has a parallel with her about, you know, Atreus and him, like, losing Freya. or sorry, losing Faye. And so I feel like they bond a lot in that section, but I feel like if you didn't do it, it might feel a little bit like rushed to just like, okay, mm-hmm. and they're fine, like problem solved.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I also did the same thing as you where I played that side quest right afterwards. So I had the same kind of result, although I didn't think of that until you mentioned it here. So yeah, that's a really good point. One note on that side quest too, I really think that was one of my favorite side quests in the game. Just watching them come to that sort of resolution and, you know, it's really powerful, especially having played 2018 and just the whole point of the game is like the conflict between the two of them. And you've gone so far with them being in that sort of cold state and the tension. It's interesting to get some resolution on that. So I like that side quest a lot, like narratively.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I love Kratos' involvement too, where he's never like, I won't force you to forgive me. Like, I totally understand if you won't. Like, what I did to you, like, is the worst thing anyone can ever do to someone. And he's so, like,
he handles apologetic. It well. Like, he's owning it. He's sincere, you know? Like, he's not mm-hmm. BSing around or making an excuse. Like, he's like, no, I did this. And, you know, like, I can't change it.
Yeah. And even, too, he says, like, I wouldn't change it. Like, I would do it again because I did what I thought was the right thing to do. But, like, I'm so sorry that that has caused you so much pain. And she eventually comes around because, you know, she understands what, like, where he's coming from, and he understands how she's feeling. And so I'm really interested to see, like, where these two go in a relationship. Like, I feel like I've seen so much stuff online about them being, like, a couple. I don't know if I necessarily think that's going to happen or if that's just, like, you know, the internet loves to ship, the internet loves to ship things and fanfics and stuff. That's true. And, yeah, I don't know if I really see it, but...
be like a third marriage for Kratos.
Yeah, I guess it would be. That would be, man. Yeah, that's a lot, bro. But Chris, you know, Chris good. He works out. So.
That's true. He's been living for a long time, I think, too. That's the other thing.
That's true. It's not like he's like 32 and he's like, yeah, on my 32. A little more concerning.
Oh my god.
So this is now the section where things start heating up. Like, you kind of assembled your team. I feel like this is kind of like the end of like the first act of the game. Like, things are now going to get set into motion. Like, we have the players in position. Now it's time to like spice it up a notch. And this is, of course, where they get back and Kratos is like, all right, we were interrupted last time. We were talking, like, where were you? Like, where have you been, Atreus? You left. You don't tell me shit. Like, and he's like full on, like they're having an argument. And Atreus is doing the like kid thing or the team thing where he's like immediately on the defensive and angsty. He's like, well, like, you don't trust me. And like, I don't trust you because you don't tell me things. And like, you totally see where they're both coming from because they don't have the information you as the player do. But as the player, like, oh my God, guys, like, he wasn't even with Owen.
If you could
like,
just sort it out, if you could just know what I know. Just
tell him, like, oh, I understand why you can't, but this is totally a like could be solved with a 5-minute conversation that they just cannot have with each other. Like, as far as they've come, there's still that barrier. And Atreus ends up running out. And it's interesting too, because like some part of the conflict is not just, it starts as Kratos and Atreus, but everybody else hops in and starts telling Atreus how bad Odin is and how he shouldn't trust him. And they're really like hounding on poor Atreus, who hasn't even gone to see Odin.
Yeah, but I think it just goes to show how desperate they are and how they're like, look, man, like our world is going to get owned if you go and like, they're worried, right? You know, it kind of makes sense why they would all chime in like that. And yeah, it definitely makes you feel like, oh man, Atreus is really getting outcast here.
But at the same time, like, and you know, you feel a struggle too. Like, he could just solve the problem, but he's made that promise to Angraboda. And, you know, he ends up wolfing out and running and leaving, and leaving Sindri behind, his companion, and all of this. But yeah, it's really tricky, and you see him kind of struggling with these things. And it's also like an interesting commentary, I think, on the concept of fate that keeps popping up, right? Is like Atreus goes to Odin eventually because everybody's giving him so much trouble about going to Odin. And it's like that classic like self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Where like the second you try to stop a prophecy from happening, you push it into gear every single time. And this is definitely what's happened here. And so he doesn't leave necessarily to go to Odin first. He goes to Midgard for a little bit and he finds the turtle, which Freya, oh my God, are you not feeding your house turtle? Like, what kind of pet owner are you? It's outrageous. Later on, she gives Kratos shit about not taking enough care of his wolves. And it's like, dude, your turtle was literally starving and freezing. And not only is he your pet, he's your house. So it's double bad.
It's double bad. And you know what? Thank God you get there when you do, because that turtle is like, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like it's being neglected. Like it's like on death's door, you know, like it's not going to hang on. This might be its last day if Atreus doesn't get there. You want to talk about fate. That's fate right there.
Exactly. He's got three little turtle feet in the grave and poor Atreus shows up. It makes him a fire. Everything's okay. But then, of course, you spend this whole section being like, okay, like, oh, he's definitely going to Asgard. And okay, maybe he's not. And then, of course, yeah, he ends up in Asgard.
Of course you are.
Of course. And this is, holy shit, this is cool. You climb that wall and you meet Heimdall for the first time. Yeah,
just back up for a second here. Asgard is stunning when you first arrive there. And it looks different, you know? It's like bleak in a way. And there's not a lot there. Like, you're just kind of on these mountains and there's water. And it's just... But at the same time, it's just awe-inspiring. And then you see the hill or the wall in front of you, and you're just like, oh my God, it's massive. Like the scale of some of the things in these games is just awe-inspiring, you know? And I thought the wall was just pretty impressive.
You're right. This is another area where I got the photo, the screenshot button out, and I clicked it quite a few times. Yeah, it is incredible, those little areas that you climb up to. And eventually you meet Heimdall, who is a very interesting character. And he doesn't trust Atreus in the slightest. So I think he's getting some comeuppance. I see us killing Heimdall at some point in the future. Though he is definitely not going to go on without a challenge. And he's funny too. Like there's just a few little moments, like I mentioned how funny this is, where like you're there and you're kind of following him, but there's like some chest to pick up and stuff. So I went and looted like a chest with him. He's like, wow, you're just going to steal our hack silver? I was like, oh God, Heimdall's watching. Heimdall, I'm sorry. He does. You can't trick him. And then the fight you have with him is really cool when turns out he's like actually leading you astray and you try to fight him, but he's dodging every single attack you throw at him. He's like
Anderson Silva-ing you. He's just weaving back and forth.
He's an absolute snake. Then of course Odin shows up and saves the day. And I think Odin is the character right now where every single time he's on screen, I'm cheering inside because you know he's like a piece of shit, this guy. Like, you know he's up to no good, but he's so good at it. Like, he's so manipulative. He's so, like, slimy in that way where, like, I can't tell you what exactly he's planning, but I know I shouldn't trust him. But also at the same time, I, like, every word out of his mouth is like honey, and I'm just like, I'm like soaking it all up.
It's exactly like the way you describe that is like poetry. It's so perfect, you know? Like he is so genuine, like the way that he's talking to Atreus, and he's like, oh, you know, you can just help me with this thing, you know, and I understand where you're coming from. It must be hard, like, and you just believe it. Like he really cares, except like you say, you just know he doesn't. Somehow some ways, like, got this own interest or something's gonna change. But yeah, he's captivating though. That performance, I'm blanking on the actor's name. But I just love that, like, he kind of has, like, the Gestapo, like, mafioso quality to him, you know? Like, I just love it. Yeah, Odin is for sure a top character.
And not only is he, like, manipulating the hell out of anyone, like, he's so, like, genuine in the sense of, like, you never feel like he's pandering to you, which I think is the most important part about it, is that, like, when he's talking to Heimdall and Heimdall is going on, he's like, oh, Atreus is going to betray you. Like, I've seen it in his eyes. And Odin just says, he's like, of course he's gonna betray me, like, that's why he's here, you idiot. Like, you don't think I
he's
don't
so
know
far
that?
Beyond, like, he's so far beyond everyone else, right? He's playing a different game. Like,
exactly, he's playing like 4D chess where everyone else is playing like tic-tac-toe. Like, he just goes on, like, but like he'll change his mind, like he doesn't know me yet, he'll get to know me. And then you get to roam around Asgard and it's just the best. Like, you meet Thor's daughter and you think she's gonna like go off on you, and then turns out she's cool, and you meet like Lady and there's just so many good little cameos in the section that I really hope I get to spend more time in Asgard, even though I know it's a bad place for Atreus to be. So I spend all my Kratos sections trying to get him back, and all my Atreus sections like, yeah, let's keep going. But yeah, it is a masterclass in writing, and like every aspect of the game shows us, but especially these parts. And then we've got a few more sections here. Quickly, you get to hang out with a little bit as Atreus, which is just a hilarious matchup because Thor just could not give less of a shit about what's going on.
And even that even reflects, like, it's not even just narratively either, it's also in the combat. Like, I found him to be, he would kill things a lot faster than other NPCs you're with. He also, like, when there's puzzles, like, he doesn't really mess around. He just, you know, you need to break down this wall. Okay, sure. He just chucks his hammer. Like, it's like he just is so nonchalant. He's like, oh, whatever. Let's just get through this, kid. Like, I don't want to be with you.
Yeah, he is ultimate, like, brute force 100% of the time. And so that is awesome. You see Anger Boda here a little bit, briefly, which is the last time that I've currently seen her. Mm-hmm. But she's looking for the marbles, which is amazing. So I really want to see where that, like, kind of concludes by the end of the game. And she also mentions that the snake is getting bigger. The snake is growing. So I'm going to just throw this down as a little another tick on my This Is Jormungandr, the sneaky giant snake. And, of course, you get back to Odin. You find that extra piece of the mask, which, like, he totally knew you could translate the whole time. And he totally knew that you'd find it there. And I think he's guiding your every single step of the way. And he's building your confidence. And none of this is a shock to him. And the best part about Odin's manipulation is when you're down talking to him in his little, like, workshop chamber where the, like, crack is.
Yeah, the little crack room.
When you're down at Odin's crack room, as you do, he's got a chest. So I was, like, thinking to myself, like, oh, I'm going to take this chest. This seems, like, so fucking rude to just steal this chest in his crack room. But I'm going to do it. And he says to you, like, how's Heimdall comments? And he's like, oh, yeah, but you can just have that. That's fine. And you're like, oh, okay. Shit. Like, everybody's watching. But the opposite of Heimdall giving you a hard time, Odin's like, yeah, go for it. Like, we're buddies. Yeah, zero trust on that. So I think there's two last sections, which, wow, we had a lot to cover.
This has been fun, though. This is I'm so glad we're finally hashing this out, because I've been sitting on this for so long. This feels like ancient history to me, this part of the game, to be honest.
You're like, oh yeah, that happened? Weird.
Yeah, a couple times.
This is potentially my favorite part of the game now, this next section. And this is Kratos going to find the Norn.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember when Kratos went to find the Fates back in Greece, and this comes up a few times, and Kratos' idea of changing his fate was, I'm going to kill them. They can't predict my future if they're dead, which is what he does. But Kratos shows a little bit more restraint this time. But he does go to take a meeting with them. And I spoke last time when we were talking about how I was kind of disappointed that the controller, the DualSense, didn't have a lot of special Ragnarok functionality. And I think overall it's kind of a missed opportunity, which I understand is because it's also a PS4 game, so they would have to develop it, like, separately, and that's time consuming and awkward. But what it does have is when you go into Fate's cave, it starts whispering to you. So, like, those whispers and, like, the manipulation that the characters are hearing, you hear whispers coming out of your controller, and it genuinely, like, scared the shit out of me when I went in there, because there was all of a sudden, like, I think I must have the controller volume maxed out.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden there was loud whispering in my living room, and I live alone.
Just weren't ready for it. It's so sad. When you mentioned that to me, you were like, oh my God, like, the whispers. And I must have been wearing my headset at that time, or maybe my controller mic was just, or the speaker was just down, because I don't remember ever that happening for me. And I'm just so disappointed, because that sounds so cool.
It was really cool. I'm sorry that you'll have to just play Ragnarok again. That's all there is.
One day I will. There's no doubt about that. I agree with you, though. This part was really interesting. I love the way, I'm sure you're going to talk about it just in a second, but with the Kelpie, the way you get down just sort of to their little realm, like riding that. It's a fun little excursion. And it's, you know, a nice change of scenery again. This game just showing off that it can do all these different environments. Even if it is just for a minute, kind of going underwater to this section here.
Mm-hmm. Everything is so varied. And of course, like, you're getting more of these cool mythological creatures. And then obviously the Fates themselves are a massive standout when you get there. And there's that one that's kind of mocking Kratos. And he kind of loses his temper a little bit, I will say. But he loses it in a non-violent way. So that's impressive for him. And he really doesn't find what he's looking for. But I think to him, it's kind of a moment of, like, the stakes are raised again, because he's so, at least, like, not necessarily confident, but adamant that, like, fate doesn't define me, like, it doesn't matter. And then he actually goes to see fate, and he comes up completely empty handed and just has to kind of, like, skulk away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that point it's like, okay, this shit's real. Like, I need to take some action. Like, he's starting to get like a fire lit under him at this point.
Yeah, I think he's counting his options, right? And he's kind of like, okay, well, this isn't gonna work. And now he's kind of like, oh man, you know, like, and at the end of the day too, he always says his number one goal is just to keep Atreus safe, and his options mm-hmm. to do so are dwindling.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, and he's kind of considering, I think, for the first time at the end of this, that like, might genuinely just die. Like, this might result in his death. Like, that is the prophecy foretold. Everything is corroborating that. And I think he's sort of like, he knows at the end of the day he'd die for Atreus, but I don't think he ever necessarily considered that, like, it is a reality that may potentially be what
the
happens.
The end of the line is, like, potentially coming up in his sight now. And I think that's something that, you're right, he probably hasn't ever. I mean, he's been to hell, like, multiple times.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's ever quite come to that type of realization, which I guess shows you the power of Odin.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, that's got to be a weird thing, the mortality of an immortal god. Now yeah. we're wrestling with stakes officially raised. And then we have one last section to finally end off on. And this is the next part where you just cry like an absolute child because, oh my God, you get to hang out with Brock. And I was so excited when Brock was my companion because he was new. He's so much fun. I think Brock is like the most underrated character in this game so far.
And him and Kratos too, like, who's going to carry the conversation type of thing. It's just such a,
right?
I think out of, if you were to say to me, like, before this game, like, which combination of two characters would be the funniest to listen to talk, it would probably be Brock and Kratos, just because of, you know, the way they speak. Like, no one's going to carry that conversation. Brock is just, he's so funny the way he rambles on.
And Brock is so funny. Every single thing I wrote down on here, two big notes about how funny Brock is. And one of them is that he rides on your back when you like do a climbing section, which is like, just, that's a cherry on top. And then also he's got a line where when he's getting close to like that forge that he's taking you to, he tells you he's so nervous that he's got goosebumps on his bunions.
You know what's so funny is I had written down that exact quote right here for when we got to that part, because it's just like, it just comes out of nowhere, and it's just, oh my God, the way that he would
everything
use that word.
Everything Brock says, it's the delivery. If anyone else said it, it wouldn't be funny, but mm-hmm. because it's Brock, like the voice actor, like that guy, nominate, like get him nominated at the Game Awards next
time.
Yeah,
best supporting actor.
Oh my God.
Him and Sindri, honestly, best supporting duo.
Yeah, they really are. I love Brock and Sindri. And then, oh my God, when Brock realizes what has happened to him when you finally get down in the forge. And Brock is thoughtful. Like, he's a mm-hmm. thoughtful guy. He is not an idiot. Like, he tells you on the way there that it's things, it's not the nature of a thing that's important. It's the form, or sorry, the nature of the thing is more important than the form of a thing, which is a very poetic thing to come from a man like Brock. And he's kind of like picking the air up as you go, and he's leading you down in this underwater place. And it's, again, like Kratos is really like outmatched here in the sense of like, he is totally a fish out of water. He would be so lost without these other characters kind of leading him along the way. And yeah, Brock is like a really talented, accomplished dwarf. And he's smart. He's, you know, he's rough mm-hmm. around the edges.
And you
sure.
wouldn't have
he's
thought that, you're right. Like, that's, no more stereotyping, you know, just like they stereotype the light elves and the dark elves in the first game. Mm-hmm. We stereotype Brock, I wouldn't fear.
Exactly. And then Brock finds out that he has, in fact, died, and he doesn't have a soul. And poor Kratos consoles him, and he gets him to be the one that blesses the weapon, because it doesn't matter about the form, it's the nature. And he like says Brock his line back while mm-hmm. he's blessing the spear. And you know, that's the moment where you just decide like, yeah, I need a cup of tea. I'm not crying in the kitchen while I take a break to like, you know, let this sink in. I just really was thirsty, and that's all there is to it. I don't have anything else to say on that matter.
Listen, I kind of felt a little tear coming right now when you were recounting this to me. It's just the most thoughtful thing you could possibly do for someone in Brock's situation, you know, and it's like a lovely moment, and you know, it's like two, it's also two male characters showing like masculine weakness, you know, like in a way that's very different than how like Kratos used to be the poster boy for like, you know, we're strong, like feelings are dead.
Toxic you know? Night masculinity.
Yeah,
on Kratos.
It's like, it's cool to see that, and you're right, just the story for Brock, and you can totally see like it comes back full circle then, like why Sindri was so adamant that Brock cannot go visit the lady in the mm-hmm. forge as well. And like, you know, you wonder what kind of drama could have gone down with that. You assume at the time it's like, because, you know, she's going to be tough to negotiate with and Sindri's got the silver tongue compared to Brock, but it actually is like, no, it's this way more sentimental and heartbreaking mm-hmm. reason. And Sindri was just trying to protect him and all that, you know, even though it's, you know, such a controversial thing between the two of them, because he doesn't mm-hmm. know, you know, it's just a magic moment for sure.
Exactly. So I'm glad that that was kind of where I have last left off, because it was such a mm-hmm. powerful moment. And I think like I'm really anticipating the next time Brock and Sindri see each other, because obviously there's going to be some conflict there. And, you know, they've been through some problem times and had resolutions. So I got my fingers crossed for the brothers. I think they'll be okay. But yeah, it was just such a powerful moment. And I think I messaged you after it happened. I was like, I never would have thought, like, back in high school when I was playing the Greek games, that here I would be all these years later and I'm like crying because Kratos was like being so sentimental and gentle and like beautiful to another character.
100%.
But man, 100%. Here we are. What a game Ragnarok has shaped up to be. And this isn't even talking about how fun the spear is. Like, I think maybe that's one for next time. I think I want to play a little bit more with it.
Yeah.
And just get some more combat in. But
yeah.
Oh my God, I think it looks like a really fun weapon. So this is an awesome moment in terms of like storytelling, character development, and then also like a thing for gameplay reasons as well. And when you marry all three of those things together so frequently, like God of War Ragnarok does, that's how you make a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I will say, now we've given this game a lot of praise, the only thing up to this point that I would say, if I'm reflecting on my experience, that I would have brought up as a negative at this point to wrap it all up, would be that as much as we've praised the cast, I don't know how much I like Freyr. Freya's brother.
Okay, Freyr.
Freyr. I don't know how much I like him. He seems a little bit like a used car salesman, you know, in a way that's like an archetype character that's a little different than some of the others. I don't know. He just kind of didn't give me the same sort of well-realized vibe. Some of the others, but maybe he's a bit more of a supporting character anyway. It's not really fair to judge him on the same merit.
I was a little cooler on him as well. I mean, Lunda's the standout character there. The other one is that guy, and I don't even think he gets a name, but he's just one of the guys in the camp that is just this massive sword, massive blue glowing sword. Like, that guy was cool. But yeah, Freyr, I agree, I was a little bit cool on. But I also think that's just a testament to like how much we've gotten of the characters before. Or, like, I would have said some of the characters were a little bit archetype-y in 2018. Like, Brock and Sindri were largely, like, comic relief. Like, we didn't get as much depth with them. So now that we've kind of had them pre-established, we're getting so much more character and we're getting a more full picture of who they are. Whereas I think Freyr is kind of like, if he was in 2018, he wouldn't have stood out as much. But in Ragnarok, where everyone's got so much more depth, he does seem a little bit more, like, kind of surface level. But I think that's a fair critique that, I was kind of like, you know, I sort of forgot about him once we left that area.
Right. But anyway, like that's such a small little nitpick, you know, it's a really cool game, part of the game you're in. And I can't wait to see what you think about what happens next.
We better get on to the next part of the game. Talk about despots real quick so that I can go play some more before I have to go to bed.
That's right. We have more to talk about, folks. We have one more topic on the show today before listener mail, of course, and that is Despots game. You know, because when you finish a game like God of War, you just want to bounce around on Game Pass for a little while and chip away at little indie things here and there and play some small short stuff before you dive into your next big huge game here. So this is Despots game, which I'm going to play a little video of while we talk about it. So I'm going to mute it, though. The music's not really very important, so you can watch along if you're a video listener. But this is Despots game. So it is a roguelike game where you're kind of moving through rooms and upgrading your units and, pretty standard stuff for roguelikes, except there's some really interesting stuff about this one. Number one, it's an auto battler. So you're basically just summoning units, putting them into different rooms and seeing how you fare and seeing how long you can stay alive. And the premise is that you're kind of a bunch of humans and you're stuck in this kind of like a portal type of story, I guess. Like this robot has you trapped in wherever you are here, and it's playing a game with you. It's trying to torture all these humans and like make them fight each other. And it's kind of Squid Game-y, I guess, in a way too. But so you're going through, you have all these different stick people, like you can see here. And the idea is that you're upgrading them with different weapons that you find. So you start off, you have like an archer and a shield person and one with a sword and then one human with like no weapon. And then as you go, you encounter like stores and you can buy them different things. You can get them all types of crazy things. There's like, you know, standard types of weapons, but you can also get they call them like nerd class guys. They have like beakers and they shoot, you know, stuff out of the beakers at the enemies. You can have some really ridiculous ones. Like you can have a football and your guy turns into a football player and like throws it at the enemies. You can throw stale pretzels at them and it's like something that hurts the enemies a lot. Just some really wacky stuff, which is kind of cool to go through. And, you know, some of the joys of these games, I think, is always going through and seeing the variety of like what ridiculous types of weapons you can have. I had one time I think it was the cape. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it turned one of my stick people into Saitama from One Punch Man. And so it was like a melee class. Pretty funny. And so that's kind of what you're doing, is you're just going through and trying to maintain your team and upgrade it as best you can. Each of these stick people has a health bar, and so they can die. They have a chance of, if they die, the weapon they're holding can sometimes come back, sometimes it doesn't. So you have a chance of like losing your equipment as you go, but you're always kind of cycling through. When you get to the store, you're buying some new stick people and buying new weapons and upgrading the store, and then you'll have some that die, and you're kind of maintaining this army as you go. And there's a couple currencies that you're using while you do this. You can see at the top left, if you're watching on the video, there's hunger meter and then there's like a currency meter. So the way the hunger works is that you have to basically use the, well, I'll start with the currency, actually. Let's back up. The currency you can use for three separate things. Number one is buying food. You have to have enough food to feed all your units. As you move through the rooms, the food counter kind of goes down. And if they begin to be hungry, then they'll have like debuffs, basically. So you'll have a tougher time.
It's tough to throw those stale pretzels when you're thinking to yourself, right, what if I just eat what them? I'm kind of hungry.
Yeah. Then you're beginning to think about eating the football, and that's just really desperate. And yeah,
that's a bad shape to be in.
Yeah. So aside from that, the other things you can do with the currency, also at the top, there's like a little skill tree. It's pretty basic, but it's things like increased HP, increased armor, mana and whatnot for the characters. Like you just kind of, you can buff them over time. And the third thing is at the store, there's also where you buy like the weapons and the characters and rerolling and stuff like that. So you're kind of managing those two meters as you go. Personally, like, it is kind of a balance. I haven't really found the best strategy yet. I haven't played enough to really know if it's really worth really stockpiling the food or upgrading in the skill tree or going for the weapons. I've tried a variety, and this game has been pretty challenging, I would say. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I don't really understand, and that kind of brings me maybe to some of the negatives of the game, which is that I find it's confusing. Like, it has a lot of mechanics going on, and if you can see at the top, there's sort of like some icons at the top showing like what kind of classes your characters are. There's like a sword for fencers, and there's shooting, like gun classes, like they're called, I think they're called a gun. Actually, I don't really remember, but either way. Yeah, either way, there's like a lot of different ones, and it doesn't really explain what they all do. And then there's also little augments you can get, which are like, oh, you know, it gives this certain effect to your fencers. But if you don't remember which icon is which, I couldn't find a way to get it to explain which was which. So like the UI is kind of weird, and I was just kind of guessing if those were going to be the right buffs based on like, oh, the shield is probably the defender one, but I'm not sure. And then some of them are more ambiguous than others. And so I had a bit of a tough time with the UI, and I think a lot of it honestly comes down to the controls. Now, I'm playing this on Game Pass on my Xbox with a controller. I imagine if you're a PC player, this would be probably a non-issue. But for me, this is one of the least controller-optimized games I think I've ever played. Like, the way that I've tried to figure out this menu is basically I've developed my own way of, like, sometimes I use the cursor. You can turn it on, sort of have it with your joystick. Some things you can't click on with that mode, though. So you have to press select, and then you become, like, the non-cursor mode where you can kind of menu around through the different buttons. And it's just this weird combination. Like, if I want to hover over one of my stick people, I have to, like, turn the cursor off because the cursor won't hover them properly, so I have to like button over to them. It's really bizarre, and it really inhibits me from like playing this game as efficiently as I think I'd like to, because it just isn't really worth my time to go through and look at all like the stats and really get into it.
That sounds incredibly awkward, especially if the UI is not as clear as it should be in the first place. And to add on the additional issue of like you can't see everything you're supposed to.
I know.
That does sound like bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, it really has been, but I think it just goes to show like I'm interested in this game, and it's almost been like kind of it's just something different to play while I'm like, you know, killing some time or having dinner or something. I don't really have to pay attention. I can just kind of play a run or two of this. And it's fun. Like, I'm just trying to figure out the best way to go. And I think part of the reason I've been struggling a little bit is because I probably don't understand it as well as I could. But that's like the biggest negative, because it is interesting. There's sometimes like these text prompts come up once you get to like a new floor of the dungeon. Once you beat a boss, it kind of comes up and it's supposed to be that robot talking to you, and you've got to make a little decision which can get you a bonus for your character. But the coolest thing about this game, and this is the last thing I want to tell you before I'm kind of done with them, there's not a lot more to tell, but this game has a really, really cool feature where it actually has PvP in it, and you can play a different version where instead of working your way, as you can see here, like down the different floors, beating the bosses, going down to like level 2, level 3, level 4. The PvP mode is like you get 3 hearts at the top. And so what you do is you go through 2 rooms, and then in every third room, you actually fight another player's squad of humans. So you actually like take them on, and you have 3 lives. If you lose, all your guys just respawn, and then you keep going. And you have to just try and build the best army that you can and see how many like players you can basically take a heart from, kind of like the Mario Kart balloon battle, I guess. But it's really cool. Like, I would never have thought a game like this. It'd be like, you know, every 5 rooms in Slay the Spire, you're like, your enemy is another player or something. Like, it's a really cool concept.
Right.
And I think part of the reason it works well in this game, I've only played it a couple times, like in that mode, but it's because it's an auto battler. So you're really just trying to build the best army that you can. You can't like, you know, think you're doing really well and then you get like beaten up by someone that's played 200 hours of this and is, you know, just really proficient with the controls. Like, it's kind of just cool to watch your armies fight each other.
That's cool. Yeah. And that actually makes sense that it works well, because the like modern auto battlers now are like PvP games, right? Like, mm-hmm. You think like League of Legends has that big one. And there's a few other ones
auto
as well.
Chess,
like a lot
right?
of the MOBAs have done it. Yeah, they're doing all the auto chess, which this to me seems like kind of like, it's in that sort of same vein where you're just getting upgrades and seeing like how far you can make it. So my question to you then is because it's a roguelike, are there features for things that are like between runs? Like, do you get permanent upgrades, or is it just like see how far you can get every time?
I'd say it's light from what I've been able to notice. Like, every run I've unlocked something you could, like, it expands the arsenal of weapons you can have. So you can like find more different things in the store. So it does have that. And the other thing that it has too is that there's different starting loadouts that you can have. So I haven't unlocked any personally, but I think I've made it to like the third floor boss or something. So I think if you probably make it to a certain point, it would probably let you start with a different selection of weapons. Because for me, it's always the crossbow, the sword, the shield, and the plain person is my starting class. So I probably imagine that's the only stuff, though. It's not like Rogue Legacy or something where there's like tons, tons and tons of unlocks, and there's no currency that you hold between rounds. So it's a bit light on that side as well, which is why I think overall I wouldn't say this is one of my favorites, just because that sense of progression is lessened. Just because I'm not, you know, the dopamine of like Vampire Survivors a couple times ago. That's a great roguelike. You're unlocking stuff all the time. You're like powering things up. Very different than this.
Yeah, I would say like that sense of progression is very important for me. Looking at this, I'm like, okay, I'm kind of interested. Like, I'm considering downloading it. Like, my Game Pass on PC, like, I can use mouse. It's going to be great. But it is that I need that sense of progression. But if there's a lot of interesting, like, things to unlock that you can just use in future runs, even if they're not necessarily better, like, that to me is still feels like a sense of progression. Like, that's how Slay the Spire works, right? Like, Slay the Spire largely is just like, now you can use these different cards, or now you can get these different, like, you know, like relics and stuff, but like, you're still starting from scratch every single time. Like, you don't get stronger between runs, you just get better at the game and have more resources. So I guess, like, in a sense, that's still progression. And so I've not talked myself out of it yet.
No, you're right. I think the argument I'd make there is like Slay the Spire, I think, is a higher skill ceiling in the sense that you have more determination on like how the battles go, and you're actually getting better at playing the game too. For this, you're kind of just memorizing like, oh, that guy was really strong last time, so I guess I'll take him again kind of thing. And it's a little bit less involved, but I see what you're saying. And you're not wrong for sure. I think you should play this. If for nothing else, I want to see how you like it on PC, because I think it'll be dramatically better on PC.
I should play it as an experiment just to see how much I understand the game.
Please do. Okay.
I'll play like 3 hours and then I will be your FAQ. You ask me questions, and if I know, we know it's horrible. If I don't know, the game needs to be more clear.
It's perfect. Okay, everybody, let's get to the show wrapped up here. But of course, before we do, we always like to end off with a listener mail question written in from someone in the audience. It's always fun to see what you guys write in with. And today we have a nice simple question, but a fun one to think about from our friend Ryan. So Kate, go ahead with the question.
It's a nice, cute, simple one. He says, if you could own a console that you have never owned, what would it be?
So, I mean, immediately to my head, first of all, thanks again, Ryan, for the question. Really appreciate it. I mean, the real answer is the Steam Deck, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking too. I was like, it feels a little bit like cheating, but it's the Steam Deck because it's new and I don't have one.
That's what I was going to say is like the Steam Deck is for sure. It's like for sure, hands down, the thing to answer. I mean, for me, I guess I could say like a gaming PC, but then you're like, oh, is it a console? Is it a PC? I don't know. I'd still take the Steam Deck. Honestly, that portability seems super cool. But because that was such an easy, obvious answer, what was your second answer for this, if you had to think about it?
So my answer is actually the first thing I thought of, which then led me to the Steam Deck. And the first thing I thought of was a Vita, because I borrowed your Vita. It's a great little handheld. There's a lot of like good games that are kind of Vita exclusive. And so that was the first thing I thought of, and I would be very pleased to have one. And then I kind of went from there to like, oh, the Steam Deck's also a handheld. I'd rather have a Steam Deck.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I mean, obvious answer for me. I would have said the Vita for sure too. If you ever get a Vita, you won't regret it. Okay. It's a great little handheld. For me, I have to think, cause I've owned, like, aside from the classic stuff, you know, like the real, like Super Nintendo and earlier, I feel like I've owned a big portion of them. Like I used to have an original Xbox and I wouldn't want that anymore anyway with like the Series X being so versatile. You know what it is for me is something we never had when we were growing up was I would take a Dreamcast just because of how different that thing is and how little we had really played it at the time. Like when it was, you know, around the PS2, GameCube kind of generation. You know, the only time I ever really remember playing a Dreamcast was like at Future Shop in those little kiosks where you could sample the games. So I think I'd pick it just for that reason. And, you know, and it's got that interesting controller with like the screen in the middle of it. And I think the memory cards like go in the top, if I remember correctly. And then the other thing, too, is it's got like the original Sonic Adventure game on there, which is it's kind of cool. Like it's inspired of SA2B. And I know there's like other games like Nights into Dreams and like Crazy Taxi and a couple like Phantasy Star RPGs. Like it seems to have some classics on there, even though I know it doesn't have like a ton of games and it kind of died really quickly after it came out. But it's a cool little piece of gaming history and like the last console Sega made. And so I think I'd go with a Dreamcast.
Answer just in terms of like variety or something that would be like more unique to own. It would be like certainly a cool novelty thing to just like have for a month.
Yeah, yours is definitely more functional though. Like if I ever did get a Dreamcast, I feel like I would, you know, have a really cool fun weekend like sort of plugging it in and like, oh whatever, come over and we'll like check it out. But then I think I just put it away and like wouldn't play it. So the Vita, I think you'd get more use out of your Vita than I would out of the Dreamcast.
I think we'd both get significantly more use out of the Steam Deck than either of those other two options.
That's for sure. So
yeah.
Anyway, thanks for the question, Ryan. Again, that was you know, fun to think about those kind of things, I guess. So if you would like to be cool like Ryan and write a question for us on the next show, you can do so to cloudcontrolpod@proton.me or reply to our tweets. We tweet all the time asking for questions. So just respond on there and we'd love to take your question and answer it next time. And that's going to close us out for the day. So thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed our thorough breakdown of God of War. And let's look forward to Ant-Man together, everybody. So until next time, this has been Cloud Control, the gaming podcast. It's not just good, it's good enough. And we'll see you on the next episode.